mother stood beside me, smelling of Vicks and the Chanel No. 5 samples I had given her from work. She looked at me with her tiny brown eyes iced over with bluish cataracts. I wondered how she saw anything. She stirred the pork until the chunks were browned and then submerged them in the chili, little by little, with her wooden spoon. "You knew her best," she said abruptly, still staring into the pot, her tone like an accusation directed toward anyone. "You knew her best, Corina." The other women stopped what they were doing. They stared at me, their ears nearly rising out of the strands of their black hair, wolf-like, as they waited for my response. I didn't tell them I hadn't seen or spoken to Sabrina in months, and by that time, she wasn't the Sabrina I knew anymore. I placed the cutting board in the sink and washed my hands. When I was 11 and Sabrina was 12, we crawled barefoot out of our grandmother's attic window and stood on the roof above the porch. Though it was nearly fully dark, under our feet the shingles still felt warm from the evening sun. We took in the view of Denver's budding skyline from my grandmother's West Side neighborhood. Skyscrapers rose like granite cliffs, whitish and bleak against the night. Our family's church, St. Joseph's, stood nearby on the corner of 6th Avenue, bells ringing as indoor lights twinkled through stained glass windows. We lay down, our hair spreading between us, our arms folded beneath our necks. Above us, miles into the sky, an airplane's red light coasted through the dark. Sabrina held her left hand in front of her face, moving it closer to her eyes and then further away. Her nails were sparkly blue, and the friendship bracelet I had made for her moved up her wrist. "What's your first memory in the entire world?" she asked. "I can't remember." She lightly slapped my arm. "Try." I closed my eyes, and I saw Sabrina and myself as babies near a mountain lake beneath a blanket the color of marigolds with plastic mirrors woven into the fabric. The blanket caught and held light, as if covered in a small portion of the sun. A honeybee floated down from the cloudless sky, landing on my cheek. "It's probably that time I got stung by a bee," I said. "We were little and with our moms in the mountains." Sabrina squinted into the murky night. Very few stars were visible, and there was no moon. "You're such a copycat, Corina. That was me. I was the one who got stung." "No way," I said. "I felt it. It burned me all the way through my face and neck." She sat upright and with closed eyes shook her head. "Go ask our moms. I'm the one who was hurt." Around 11, the men began snoring on the couch and the little cousins had passed out like sloppy drunks on the floor. The women made funeral plans in the kitchen. All of us were there except Sabrina's mother, who had taken a Xanax and fallen asleep in my grandmother's bed. The rosary and viewing would be held in 2 days at Ramirez Mortuary. The funeral mass would be the following morning, then a short trip to the cemetery, and a reception afterward in the church's basement. One of my cousins said she could get us a deal on a karaoke DJ, but fortunately, another cousin told her she was a tacky idiot. We couldn't agree on a closed casket. My grandmother was against it. She spoke of funerals where an outdated picture of the departed was presented to a room of teary-eyed mourners. "Nothing like that," she said. "It's so phony, disrespectful. With no body to view, it's like they were never on this earth to begin with." "It might be better that way," my mother said. Carlos at the mortuary said her neck looks awful, real ugly and swollen.
He's just being lazy, said my grandmother.
Carlos can do all sorts of things these days with the new creams and chemicals.
One of my aunties groaned and reminded everyone that last fall, after Auntie Celia passed away peacefully in her sleep, Carlos made her face look like a pickled pig's ear.
I can only imagine what he'll do to Sabrina, she added.
If you're all so worried about it, Carlos doesn't have to do it.
My grandmother pointed in my direction. Corina can.
Do what, Grandma?
I asked, stunned.
Her makeup?
Yes, Hita, and her hair. That's your job.
I thought of the quinceañera the previous winter, where my wrists felt like they'd fall off after I did makeup and hair for 11 cousins and their friends. I had been encouraged to learn cosmetology, partly because I was good at it, and partly, I suspected, because my family loved free services and products.
I know you get them samples, my aunties would say. Hook us up with some lipstick or that anti-wrinkle cream. That shit's so expensive.
I don't do makeovers on dead people, I said.
Nonsense, my grandmother smacked the table. Put the makeup on Sabrina and make sure she looks good. Pay special attention to her neck.
I couldn't do that. I wouldn't know how. My grandmother looked at her lap and then at the stove. Her throat trembled, and she wiped her face. It was as close to crying as she ever got. She turned back to me, and I knew to say yes. Sabrina loved our grandmother's house. She especially loved the bathroom. The lighting was warm and rosy, and on each of the four walls was a full-length mirror. My grandmother believed every woman needed to know how she looked from any angle. It was important, she said, to know how the rest of the world viewed us. When Sabrina and I were in middle school, she stole a pair of heart-shaped sunglasses from the dollar store by shoving them into her sock. The next time we were both at our grandmother's house, she wore them all day, fluttering around like some starlet, flicking her wrist and puffing out her hair. At one point, she convinced me to climb onto the bathroom's pink countertop with her. She had us turn our bodies so we faced one another, our legs bent in the bowl of the sink. All around, we were reflected in the four mirrors endlessly, like one tangled spider of a girl.
I think, Sabrina said, making a kissy face at herself, that I could be a model or an actress.
Her face was a delicate oval with high cheekbones and a heavy bottom lip. But her most noticeable feature, her eyes, was covered by the sunglasses. Their pale blue color alone was striking, but the shape of them, very round and wide, is what made them unusual. Even strangers on the street said she resembled a living doll.
We should move to Cali when we're older, I said. Become movie stars.
We should,
Sabrina clapped her hands.
I can be like Salma Hayek or go blonde and be a real bombshell.
Blonde? Who wants to be blonde?
My dad was a blonde. At least, he wasn't those pictures my mom has.
Sabrina often mentioned these photos, the only glimpse either of us had seen of her father. He took off before she was born. My grandmother told me he was a nobody, some white guy with a name like a stuffy nose, Stuart or Randall.
I don't care if your dad was blonde. You look better with hair like me and our mom's. You'd look adopted if you had stringy yellow hair.
And I don't look adopted now? Not even with my blue eyes?
No way.
You look like a Cordova, I said.
So, if you're Salma Hayek, Who am I? Which actress?
A look of deep concentration came over Sabrina's face. She smiled.
You can be my personal assistant.
You wish, I said. What about Dolores Del Rio?
Who the heck is that?
She's from Grandma's old-time movies, the kind without words. Sabrina slid the heart-shaped sunglasses off her face, her eyes bright beneath them.
That's just dumb. No one wants a girl who doesn't talk. You might as well be dead.
Ramirez Mortuary was on the corner of a busy intersection north of downtown. An undistinguished house with reflective windows and plastic marigolds lining the cement pathway to the entrance. Nothing about it, inside or out, had changed much over the years. The carpet was still seafoam green, the walls still creamy pastel, and the sofa in the sitting area, where I was to meet Carlos, was still bubblegum pink. I sat down and glanced through some pamphlets on loss and grief spread over a glass coffee table. They all had glossy photos of beautiful white-haired people with pinched features and light eyes. Sabrina would have looked like that had she grown old. Our cousins used to give her a hard time.
With eyes like that, they'd say, you look like one of those dogs, a husky or maybe a wolf.
My grandmother told Sabrina to ignore them. She said people will find the loveliest part of you and try to make it ugly. And they will do anything, she always said, to own that piece of you.
I can spot a Cordova from a mile away, Carlos said, marching toward me, one hand on his hip, a short man with a thin mustache and a paisley western shirt. His black hair had thinned since I last saw him at Auntie Celia's funeral.
I tossed the pamphlets back onto the table and handed him a duffel bag of Sabrina's things, a modest red dress, a quartz rosary, silk flowers for her hair, an old photograph.
Like you asked for. I didn't bring any shoes, though. My grandma told me you wouldn't need those.
Dead people, he said, are like white people. They can't dance.
I laughed a little. You make that one up?
Oh, yes, honey. That's how it goes.
He led me down a carpeted hallway with yolk-colored squares. After my godfather died of hepatitis in the early 90s, Sabrina and I used those squares to play hopscotch. At the end of the hallway, he opened a door to a showroom of caskets. Many were dark wood, some shiny metal, and a few radiantly white. In the corner were smaller versions for children. Carlos leaned against the smallest one.
Before we head into the other room, I want to go over some things.
I nodded.
Number one, if you don't want to do this, you don't have to. Number two, you have 2 hours. The wake starts then. And number three, this is a favor for your grandmother. Don't tell anyone I let you do this.
So that's it? There's nothing else?
Wait here. I'll go ahead and put on her dress. I'll call you in when the body's ready.
Carlos pulled a set of keys from the retractable chain on his belt. Before opening the door, he said,
And I'm sorry about Sabrina. She was a beautiful girl. Really, she was.
We were inseparable in high school. Sabrina was my best friend, my closest cousin. My father would give me a hard time, ask if I ever tired of carrying her dead weight, but Sabrina was fun. She was vivid and felt everything deeply, from heartbreak to the drunken nights we stayed up until 4 a.m., mapping out our tiny lives with enormity only Sabrina could imagine. To her, everything was possible. Money, true love, a way out of Colorado. Even after she dropped out in 11th grade to work at a sports bar downtown,
I used to do homework in a back booth, marveling at the way she glided between tables, sleek and fluid, with her long hair curled around her elegant neck. Men would follow her between their bites of onion rings and beer-battered fish, insatiable, as if my cousin was just another symptom of their hunger. After graduation, my father offered to pay for cosmetology school. He said that I needed to do something besides run around like other Cordova women. He mostly meant Sabrina, of course, who by that point had started showing up to family dinners smelling like a barroom floor. But it wasn't just her. There was the distant niece whose infant son was taken away by the state, the cousins who died messing around with heroin, great Auntie Dodie left blind after a date with the wrong man, and Auntie Liz found dead in her Chrysler, the motor running and the garage door locked. My grandmother hardly mentioned Auntie Liz, except to say that what killed her had killed them all. While I was studying cuts and colors, perms and relaxers, Sabrina continued working in bars and sleeping with men who all looked alike. Tall, thick-necked, green eyes or blue. In my mind, these men formed a lineup of indifferent masculine faces, a continuation of the withdrawn expression I had seen in those old photographs of Sabrina's father. Sometimes she'd visit me at the beauty college. She would stand at my station in wrinkled clothes, looking like she'd just woken up at noon. While the other girls snickered and popped their gum, Sabrina would scoop away her hair and I'd see the bruises, hickeys like rotten goose eggs down her throat. "They'll send me home from work," she'd say, and I'd always help her conceal everything. After finishing beauty school, I rented a studio apartment on the west side that overlooked an abandoned public pool. At night, on my second floor balcony, I'd sit and wonder about the missing diving board, replaced with an orange traffic cone, as if that could stop someone from leaping headlong into hard cement. It was a lonely place, and Sabrina only visited during the rare times when she was single. She'd come over and shadow me throughout the apartment, like a child who was afraid she'd stop existing if someone wasn't there to see her.
"You ever do makeovers on women who look hideous without makeup?"
She was sitting on the lid of my toilet with two Coronas between her thighs, one for each of us. We had the radio on an oldies station, the type of music our mothers played when we were little girls and they would drive us through the mountains in summertime. "Sure," I said, smiling, "but after I fix them up, nobody can tell."
"I guess only they can."
Sabrina checked her reflection in the mirror, smudging her berry lip liner with her left pinky.
"And of course you."
We went to a bar on the edge of the city near a highway overpass. Neon signs hung in the foggy windows. We played a couple games of pool and drank shots of cheap tequila. Every now and then, Sabrina danced over to the old-school jukebox and flipped through the records, the light flickering over her face, her reflection a floating bust on the glass. I sat at the bar and watched a group of men circle around her. They held their beers close to their chests and waited for an opportunity to move in like vultures.
"We're going outside for a cigarette," Sabrina said.
Two pale-faced guys with broad shoulders and thick necks stood behind her, nervously casting glances my way, as if afraid I'd ruin their fun.
"But you don't smoke," I said. "I picked it up," she said, "just now."
I watched through the front window as she stepped outside and flopped against a parked minivan, twisting her hair around her fingers, her smile all teeth. The men stood next to her, packing their smokes. Neither was in her league. But Sabrina had a way of talking to men like she was a gift, an offering of an expressive, pretty face and a girlish giggle. It didn't matter who it was, so long as they gave her attention back. After a while, I couldn't watch her anymore. I swiveled around on my stool and tried to catch the bartender's attention. He eventually came by, a white washcloth over his shoulder.
"That your sister?"
he asked, glancing out the window.
"Not my sister."
I looked at Sabrina tossing her hair back, the cords of her neck forming a shoot to her collarbones.
"My cousin." "I knew you two were related."
He poured tequila and set it before me.
"You look similar."
"Not really," I said, and swallowed my shot. When Sabrina hobbled back inside, she could hardly stand in her wedged platforms. The men guided her by her wrists. She swayed between them until they released their grips, and Sabrina leaned over me, her perfume gone rancid with hints of rotten fruit, something that belongs in the trash.
"Karina, Karina, having fun?"
I glared at the two guys beside her. They were far less drunk than Sabrina and beaming with pride, as if they had already gotten her into a cab headed for one of their apartments.
"Let's get going," I said.
Sabrina squinted at me. Tiny wrinkles had begun to form around her eyes and lips.
"You can leave me here," she said. "I'll get home okay."
With my hands firmly around her wrists, I towed her to the front door. The two men laughed, backed off, and began to circle around another girl a few stools down. The bartender pulled the white washcloth over the bar, eyeing the two of us while we left with what I thought was pity.
"Let's go."
I was gripping Sabrina's wrist harder than necessary. She wobbled behind me, and I squeezed tighter and angrier, worried my nails would mark her skin.
"Don't you care how people look at you?"
Outside, the air was cool, the moon surrounded by a thin cloud. I kept dragging Sabrina to the car as she tottered behind me, her face to the sky like that of a dreamy child. When I finally let her go, she steadied herself against my trunk, opening her blue eyes wide.
"They look at us the same way, Karina."
She laughed and pointed to my face.
"They look at us like we're nothing."
I told her to get into the car and said she was drunk. As we drove home, I glanced at her worn-out face resting against the window, and I felt something unknowable about Sabrina, some sadness at her core that moved between us like a sickness. Where did it come from? Or had it always been there, growing inside her, filling her lungs with its liquid weight?
"Sabrina,"
I whispered, tapping her shoulder, but she was already asleep. And for the first time in my life, I missed someone sitting right beside me. Sabrina's body lay on a chrome table surrounded by clear tubes and murky chemicals. Her head was propped up on a plastic stand. Her eyes were closed and her whitish mouth curdled along the edges. The room smelled of singed skin, disinfectant, and vinegar.
"These pretty girls," Carlos shook his head. "They get themselves into such ugly situations."
I stared at Sabrina, her dark hair framing the pale column of her rippled throat. The bruising spanned her entire neck. Bluish lines edged sour yellow and circled her indented vocal cords. Broken blood vessels spread to her collarbones. Her bloated chin was tilted stiffly to the right, perched oddly above it all.
"You think you'll be okay?" Carlos asked.
I exhaled and hid my hands behind my back,
my fingers lightly shaking. I'll be fine. Where's the makeup? Carlos wheeled over a metal table. On it were several glass jars and brushes laid out in rows and a small cassette player radio.
This makeup is different. It doesn't blend as well as your traditional products, but application is mostly the same. You know about the eyes and lips, right?
What about them? Carlos ran his hand above Sabrina's eyes.
We suture them shut to set them in an attractive pose. I used the picture you gave me. She should look like herself.
He handed me the photo from his pocket. Sabrina had taken it in my bathroom mirror. She was 21, maybe 22, at the time. Carlos rubbed a freckle on Sabrina's forehead like he was polishing a piece of furniture. He turned on the radio. The Shirelles. A tune about a man doing all of us, every woman who had ever lived, wrong. Carlos told me to find him down the hall when I was done. I walked around Sabrina's body. I reached out, touching her cheek, warmer than I had expected. I got to work, focusing on disguising the swelling of her temples and chin. Her right cheek had grown stiff with a ridge cutting near her lips. I filled it in with my thinnest brush and stepped back. Her lashes, I noticed, had grown longer in death. It almost made her look shy. With a boar bristle brush, I detangled her knotted strands. Her hair shone like spilled motor oil, greens and golds and blues all in that black. Corkscrewed sections bounced off my curling iron, more alive than anything else on that table. For her neck, I grabbed a lime green concealer with olive undertones, a normal base coat for problematic rosacea. I dabbed a fanning synthetic brush into the jar and swirled it over my wrist. It was a good undercoat, even and heavy. Her throat felt plastic and ribbed where notches of hardened flesh had risen and stayed. They didn't give way as I worked the brush from her collarbones to her soft chin. I covered her skin in a solid flesh tone, a small pool of makeup congealing in the cup of her sternum. I used a tissue to wipe it away. I considered checking the backside of her neck for bruising, but I realized that no one, not even my grandmother, would see. Sabrina was forever to face ceilings and casket tops padded in pink satin, and once she was lowered into her grave, her throat would collapse, slowly disintegrating into the dark. By our mid-20s, I saw Sabrina less and less. She worked nights, I worked days. She moved a few times and I lost track of her addresses, the names of her friends, the men she dated, the bars she tended. She rarely went to family dinners, but when she did, she was puffy-eyed and sallow-skinned, her slinky tops always falling off her shoulders. She'd gulp cups of black coffee like water, laughing at her own jokes, her hair swinging over my grandmother's table. After some time, we both stopped calling, and for a while, I thought she was fine with that. At work one afternoon, I was helping a white woman find blush. She was young and blonde, with a sheen to her skin that only comes from years of good nutrition, expensive moisturizers, and generations of tragedy-free living. I dusted shimmering golden rouge over her undefined cheekbones. She seemed pleased as she examined her reflection in a hand mirror.
I always feel silly spending money on makeup, she said, handing me her Amex card.
It's a good investment, I said, ringing her up. Studies show that men find a woman's face to be her most sexually appealing feature, her body second. From somewhere behind, I heard a coarse laugh
That's a lie.
Sabrina stood at my counter in a short denim skirt with a misshapen purse slung over her shoulder, a neon pink bra peeking out from her white tank top. She had parked herself beside the woman, who first gawked and then stepped quickly away, as though Sabrina was some escaped zoo animal. I did a quick scan of the sales floor, searching for my managers, but was relieved when none were in sight. Sarcastically, I asked Sabrina what she was doing there so early, at noon.
I miss you, she said sweetly. I thought tomorrow we could celebrate.
I gathered several kabuki brushes, positioning them on their base. Celebrate what?
My birthday.
Sabrina began spraying a bottle of Dolce & Gabbana's light blue down the front of her shirt.
I'm 25 tomorrow. We can shoot pool or cook dinner, like old times.
I wanted to tell her that I was busy, but when I looked across the glass counter, her makeupless face shocked me. Her skin was as gray as old meat, and her blue eyes were dull with crumbs of dried sleep in their corners. Her purse was stained, the zipper broken, the contents exposed. Crumpled tissues, capless pens, two loose dollars. Sabrina, I decided, needed me. I'm off tomorrow at 9, I said. Come over. We'll figure it out. That night and the next day, I kept thinking of Sabrina's filthy purse, its worthless contents. I made a run to the dollar store for decorations, white streamers and metallic glitter. I baked tres leches cake and wrapped presents, eyeshadow, a tester bottle of Dior perfume, lipsticks. When everything looked like a wedding cake, all shiny and pastel, I sat on my bed and waited for Sabrina to arrive. I had been asleep in the bluish light of my apartment when I woke up at midnight to someone banging on the door. Sabrina stood on the stoop, shivering in torn jeans and a hooded sweatshirt. She came inside, carrying the cold air on her body, taking a seat on my couch. Snowflakes melted in her black hair.
I walked here, she said. You wouldn't believe how much it snowed. Everything is covered in white.
I knew she was drunk by the way she spoke. Her words weren't slurred, but softer than usual, almost angelic in their lightness.
I kept thinking about that story, she said. The one about the devil at the dance. Remember?
My grandmother told the story often. A beautiful girl disobeys her family by sneaking into a midnight dance. She's only there for a short time when a good-looking man slinks toward her out of the crowd. She discovers he can dance well, and not just for an Anglo. He twirls her for hours until the girl notices the faces around her, wide-eyed and gape-mouthed. Her arms suddenly burn, then her lower back, and eventually her lips to throat, all the places where the man touched her. She screams as she notices that his feet, like the devil's, are hooved.
It's funny the way Grandma tells it, Sabrina said. When the girl notices a sour smell and it's her own flesh burning.
I told her it wasn't funny. I said it was horrible.
You've always had a shitty sense of humor, Karina.
I handed over her presents. Happy birthday, by the way. You're a day late. Where were you? Sabrina uncurled a smile, and with frenzied hands she unwrapped her gifts, shards of silver paper landing at her wet shoes. She pulled the items out one by one, blotting eyeshadow over her wrists, running lipstick across her mouth, and spraying perfume along her throat. It was like watching a toddler at their birthday party, their eyes wide with amazement as they realize that every gift, every person is there for them.
I went out, she said.
I paced between the front window and couch, the muted television the only light between us. I waited for you all night. You could have called.
I forgot.
You asked me to see you, not the other way around. Sabrina stood from the couch and moved along the kitchen wall. She opened and closed cabinet doors, pushing herself taller on her tippy toes, searching my shelves.
I don't have any booze, I said.
She turned around, peering at me through the semi-dark, her eyes almost all white.
I'm looking for a water glass.
I grabbed one from the drying rack and thrust it into her hands. She rolled it between her palms, her fingernails jagged, their ruby polish chipped.
What's wrong with you? She asked. Are we going out?
I told her bars were closing soon. I said she was too late. Sabrina filled her glass with water and gulped it down in a few swallows. She wiped her mouth on the back of her sleeve, the water running over her chin. Her carelessness disgusted me. I wanted to throw the glass out of her hands and hold a mirror to her face, forcing her to see herself.
Can't you tell what people think of you? What I think of you?
Sabrina smirked.
What does my little cousin Karina think of me?
You don't care, I said. You don't care about anything, not even yourself. Look at the way you live. Sabrina gazed toward me, her blue eyes vacant and glossy, as if she saw nothing.
So, how do I live? I mean, you would know. All you've done your entire life is follow me around.
Pathetically, I said. That's how. She gathered her gifts from the couch, tossing them loudly into the trash. She put on her hood and secured the strings around her neck.
You're down here with the rest of us, Karina. You're just too ashamed to notice.
I turned to the window, where I saw myself streaked in light.
I'm nothing like you.
You're right, Sabrina laughed. I'm not some lonely makeup girl at the mall.
You're a drunk, I said, my face burning with anger.
Sabrina opened the door, the snow falling white and golden behind her.
You've only ever had me, she said, stepping into the night. Remember that when you have no one.
I watched through the window as she walked away, shrinking smaller in the distance, streetlights casting shadows around her in wide amber shafts. After some time, I stood outside on the stoop and breathed fog-like smoke in her direction. By the time I thought of calling out her name, Sabrina was already down the block, too far to hear me, and too far to look back. I took a seat in the last row of the viewing room. Classical music played from the ceiling speakers. Sabrina's casket was open, flowers arranged on either side, an ivory curtain behind it, making it look as though she was on a stage. Aunties and uncles walked with their arms linked. They gazed down, turned their heads to the side, whispered, and stepped away. Some of my cousins smoothed her hair. My mother kissed her hands. My grandmother snapped a photo as part of her normal routine at funerals. When it was my turn, I kneeled at Sabrina's casket and touched her face. It felt colder than before. There was lipstick on her forehead where someone had kissed her. I was smudging it away when my grandmother appeared at my side.
Everyone is saying she looks beautiful, Karina.
She petted my head and kissed my cheek.
I thanked my grandmother and focused over her head at my family in folding chairs. They were arranged in rows with rosaries in their hands, their eyes swimming with muted colors. I looked at my youngest cousins, kicking their legs in white tights, pigtail braids, and red ribbons in their hair. I looked to my mother and father, dazed and accepting, numb to everything. After some time, I heard my grandmother say to my Auntie Josie, "It's what she would have wanted." I thought of all the women my family had lost, the horrible things they'd witnessed, the acts they simply endured. Sabrina had become another face in a line of tragedies that stretched back generations. And soon, when the mood hit my grandmother just right, she'd sit at her kitchen table, a styrofoam cup of lemonade in her warped hand, and she'd tell the story of Sabrina Cordova, how men loved her too much, how little she loved herself, how in the end it killed her. The stories always ended the same, only different girls died, and I didn't want to hear them anymore. "No," I said, turning back to my grandmother before taking my seat. "Sabrina didn't want any of this. She wanted to be valuable." 5 months before the wake, some girls from work invited me to a party on Colfax Avenue, in one of those stone mansions built by silver barons and their doe-eyed wives, a four-story house with a rounded balcony above a wraparound porch. Younger girls were huddled outside smoking cigarettes. They pulled deep drags and allowed the smoke to rise slowly from their heavily painted lips. One was telling a story about a guy she used to date who had recently been found stabbed to death in a dumpster. The other girls hung their heads until one of them cracked a joke. I stepped past them and went inside. There were enough people crowded in the front room that the air was humid. A few unfamiliar faces were perched on the spiral staircase, sipping beers and drinking tequila from the bottle. It was dark save for a few dim lamps and a string of twinkling Christmas lights. In the hallway, I leaned against the wall and looked on at the kitchen, where people moved to an old doo-wop song. Women danced before their men. They lifted their hair, fanning their necks, their silver hoop earrings budding against their shoulders. That's when I saw someone break away from the dancing. She pushed through the crowd, heading for the hallway. When she stepped closer to me, I saw that it was Sabrina, skinny and wet with sweat. I hadn't seen her since her birthday. She smiled with her blue eyes.
"Where you been so long, Karina?"
On the porch, Sabrina told me that she was moving to California, that she'd met a guy who was opening a bar, that she'd make tons of money.
"You should visit me once I'm settled," she said.
I told her maybe I would. A black SUV pulled up outside the party. The headlights remained on, and I could hear the dull thud of bass. Sabrina waved to the driver, who was hidden behind tinted windows. She threw her faux leather jacket over her shoulders and hurried in stiletto boots down the porch steps. Halfway across the yard, she turned back.
"What's your first memory in the entire world?"
"You know it's that time I got stung by a bee, but you claim it didn't happen to me."
"It doesn't matter," Sabrina said. "You can have that memory if you want."
She climbed into the black SUV, slamming the door behind her. As it pulled away, the window rolled down. Sabrina appeared from the shoulders up, shouting something I couldn't make out. It was winter's end. The road shimmered with black ice. All I could see was Sabrina's long hair coiling around her neck, pale as the moon.
Sisters. read for you by Alma Cuervo. And the blind man looked up and said, I can see people, but they look like trees walking. Mark chapter 8, verse 24. In the weeks before Dolores Doty Lucero had her eyesight stolen from her, she witnessed her life as if it were ordinary, taking for granted the way sunlight pressed through lace curtains as she woke in the mornings. She didn't pay special attention to her younger sister, Tina, slumped on her side and snoring loudly in her bedroom, one of her breasts slopping out of her satin nightdress. She didn't stop to behold their familiar kitchen, with iron skillets drying on the rack and cracked eggshells in the wastebasket. And outside, beyond their front windows, Doty didn't consider the cottonwood trees and sunshine elms on their side of town. The north side, along Federal Boulevard, a neighborhood of duplexes and low bungalows. On the morning the flyers appeared across the city like snow in early July, Doty went outside to fetch the newspaper after starting breakfast with Tina. She stepped out their duplex's screen door with her hair crisp in black curls and her makeup impeccable and bright. As she bent down to scoop up the Tuesday edition of the Rocky Mountain News, Doty caught sight of a misplaced whitish square. Walking barefoot over the grass, she stopped at the cottonwood tree, pulling a flyer down from the bark. The flyers were printed on cheap, brittle paper with a photograph of the girl, borrowed from the 1955 North High School yearbook, sitting dead center on the page. Missing, Lucia Barrera, 19-year-old girl of Filipino descent, works in leather goods at Montgomery Ward's, 16th Street and Tremont Street. Doty's chest ached with a hardened sadness. She lifted her gaze, eyeing the quiet street, almost hoping the missing girl would suddenly appear beside a mailbox or a parked automobile. Doty walked back inside through the sitting room, past the sofa, beneath the stucco archway and into the kitchen, where Tina sat at the table with a plate of fried potatoes and flour tortillas piled before her. She was in her nightdress. Her hair was folded against her scalp with pins. This was on our tree, Doty said in Spanish, setting the flyer on the table and taking a seat. Tina gave it a glance. She shrugged. You don't recognize her? She goes to Benny's and wears those fluttering cowgirl dresses. She goes to St. Catherine's, too, one of those Filipinos. You know, the girls who show up early for Mass and always bow lowest in the front pew. Tina stared at her sister with dismissive and faraway eyes that sat deep in her face, surrounded by mounds of cheekbones and dark brows. She could be flippant, downright oblivious, but she was Doty's best friend and only family in Denver. Tina kindly looked at the flyer once more and told her sister that she'd never seen that girl in her life. I don't really pay attention to the backs of heads at Mass, she said in English, but I guess you do. Doty swiped the flyer from the table and held it in the sunlight. She certainly knew the girl. She had first noticed her months earlier and often found herself watching her at church. Once, after Lucia had received communion, her head bowed and hands clasped in white gloves, she'd walked away from the priest and shocked Doty. Lucia had glanced in her direction, stuck out her pink tongue, and revealed the white wafer inside her mouth. She then smiled, disappearing back into her pew. Doty felt something like heat spread across the center of her dress. Lucia was very beautiful, with strong, precise eyes, and Doty felt an urge to know her. Doty said, I know you've seen her at church, Tina. What could have happened to her? Maybe she's dead. Tina gulped a glass of orange juice. Someone could have chopped her right up. Don't say something so ugly. That's horrible. Fine. She probably had a boyfriend, Tina suggested, her voice strained with annoyance. I bet they ran off and wanted to get married in a hurry. I don't think so. She didn't seem interested in that. Tina carried her dirty dish to the sink. She scraped the soggy remains of a half-eaten breakfast into the wastebasket while humming a country tune, her shoulder blades jutting from her back like stunted wings. Come off it, Dodie. Only you aren't interested in finding a man. Dodie said nothing. She reached for the flyer, running her fingernails down the missing girl's eyes, as if putting her to sleep. Tina and Dodie had lived together for 2 years, since they left Southern Colorado at 16 and 17 years old. Their mother had stayed in a town called Durango. She'd taken up with an older Anglo rancher named Weiss. In the beginning, he seemed a comfortable choice for their mother, after her first husband drank himself to death. But Weiss began showing Tina and Dodie attention neither wanted, hovering over their beds as they slept, placing his fat, calloused palms across their cheeks as they dreamed. Though they pleaded with their mother to leave him, she was too broken inside. What did they expect, she had said. Weiss had a taste for pretty Indian and Spanish girls. As a parting gift, their mother gave the sisters $27 and some advice. You girls get married sooner rather than later. You're good-looking enough. The sisters found work downtown as receptionists for a hematologist. Dodie had the morning shift while Tina worked afternoons. Dodie enjoyed the calm pace, the stack of new magazines, and the high-rise view of Civic Center Park. From her desk, she marveled at the gradual way the aspens, which grew in slim rows along the park, shifted their leaves. They went from green in summer to a color in autumn that resembled 1,000 gold coins flipped endlessly by an unseen hand. Tina tolerated the job because it held a special place in her heart. 4 months earlier, she had met her boyfriend Randy after he made a delivery on a Tuesday. That night over dinner, Dodie was shocked at the certainty in her sister's voice when she said, "He will ask me to marry him someday. I know it." Dodie, meanwhile, didn't plan on the servitude of marriage. She had no interest in men. She sometimes wondered if she'd get married at all. That evening after the flyers appeared, Dodie looked up from where she sat on the lime-colored sofa to see Tina walk in through the screen door. Her makeup had warmed in the summer heat, giving her face the look of a glazed donut. "Get up," Tina said, jabbing her sister's leg. "We're going to the movies." "It's Tuesday." Dodie was already in her lounging clothes, cigarette pants and an old billowing blouse. "The Santa Fe isn't open on Tuesdays." "We aren't going there. We're going to the other theater on a double date." The other theater never played pictures in Spanish, and Dodie suspected that, as usual, Tina had found her a date with a white man. Her sister had a thing for Anglos. They made more money. They could live and go anywhere in the city, and Tina believed each of the sisters could end up married to one. After all, they were both light-complected. But Dodie felt white men treated her as something less than a full woman, a type of exotic object to display in their homes like a dead animal. The last time Tina had set her up, Dodie endured a night out with an insurance man named Rustin Mitchell, who stank of sour mop water. At the end of the night, despite Dodie shaking her head no, he moved in for a kiss. Dodie leaned so far back that it became a game of limbo. Tina said, "I ran into this guy outside the office fixing some trees for Dr. Marcus. His name is Joey Matthews. He's got a good job as an arborist or whatever you call it. He's real good looking, tall, and, oh, Dodie, he has these baby blue eyes. You've never seen anything like it." "Sure I have," Dodie said. "Green eyes, blue eyes, black eyes, I've seen them all." Tina pulled Dodie up by both wrists from the couch. "You're going. End of it, and be nice this time. Maybe you'll know him the rest of your life." Joey Matthews stood on the stoop and introduced himself with his cowboy hat dangling from his hands. He had milky skin the same color as his hair and perfectly square teeth. Above his thin upper lip, reddish seams from a scar, a hare lip corrected, quivered as he spoke. He lowered his blue eyes as though Dodi's gaze could burn his face.